This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Daniel Deronda by George Eliot. Chapter 20. It will hardly be denied that even in this frail and corrupted world, we sometimes meet persons who, in their very mien and aspect, as well as in the whole habit of life, manifest such a signature and stamp of virtue as to make our judgment of them a matter of intuition rather than the result of continued examination. Alexander Knox, quoted in Southey's Life of Wesley. Myra said that she had slept well that night, and when she came down in Mab's black dress, her dark hair curling in fresh fibrils as it gradually dried from its plenteous bath, she looked like one who was beginning to take comfort after the long sorrow and watching which had paled her cheek and made blue semicircles under her eyes. It was Mab who carried her breakfast and ushered her down, with some pride in the effect produced by a pair of tiny felt slippers, which she had rushed out to buy because there were no shoes in the house small enough for Myra, whose borrowed dress ceased about her ankles and displayed the cheap clothing that, molding itself on her feet, seemed an adornment as choice as the sheaths of buds. The farthing buckles were bijou. "Oh, if you please, mamma," cried Mab, clasping her hands and stooping toward Myra's feet as she entered the parlor. "Look at the slippers! How beautiful they fit! I declare she is like the Queen Budur. Two delicate feet, the work of the protecting and all-recompensing Creator. Support her, and I wonder how they can sustain what is above them." Myra looked down at her own feet in a childlike way and then smiled at Mrs. Meyrick, who was saying inwardly, "One could hardly imagine this creature having an evil thought, but wise people would tell me to be cautious." She returned Myra's smile and said, "I fear the feet have had to sustain their burden a little too often lately, but today she will rest and be my companion." "And so she will tell you so many things, and I shall not hear them," grumbled Mab, who felt herself in the first volume of a delightful romance and obliged to miss some chapters because she had to go to pupils. Kate was already gone to make sketches along the river, and Amy was away on business errands. It was what the mother wished, to be alone with this stranger, whose story must be a sorrowful one, yet was needful to be told. The small front parlor was as good as a temple that morning. The sunlight was on the river, and soft air came in through the open window. The walls showed a glorious silent cloud of witnesses, the Virgin soaring amid her cherubic escort, Grand Melancholia with her solemn universe, the prophets and sibyls, the school of Athens, the Last Supper, mystic groups where far-off ages made one moment, grave Holbein and Rembrandt heads, the tragic muse, last-century children at their musings or their play, Italian poets, all were there through the medium of a little black and white. The neat mother who had weathered her troubles and come out of them with a face still cheerful was sorting colored wools for her embroidery. Hafiz purred on the window ledge, the clock on the mantelpiece ticked without hurry, and the occasional sound of wheels seemed to lie outside the more massive central quiet. Mrs. Meyrick thought that this quiet might be the best invitation to speech on the part of her companion, and chose not to disturb it by remark. Myra sat opposite in her former attitude, her hands clasped on her lap, her ankles crossed, her eyes at first traveling slowly over the objects around her, but finally resting with a sort of placid reverence on Mrs. Meyrick. At length she began to speak softly. "I remember my mother's face better than anything, yet I was not 7 when I was taken away, and I am 19 now." "I can understand that," said Mrs. Meyrick. "There are some earliest things that last the longest." "Oh, yes, it was the earliest. I think my life began with waking up and loving my mother's face. It was so near to me, and her arms were round me, and she sang to me. One hymn she sang so often, so often. And then she taught me to sing it with her. It was the first I ever sang. They were always Hebrew hymns she sang, and because I never knew the meaning of the words, they seemed full of nothing but our love and happiness. When I lay in my little bed and it was all white above me, she used to bend over me between me and the white and sing in a sweet, low voice. I can dream myself back into that time when I am awake, and it often comes back to me in my sleep. My hand is very little. I put it up to her face, and she kisses it. Sometimes in my dreams I begin to tremble and think that we are both dead, but then I wake up and my hand lies like this, and for a moment I hardly know myself. But if I could see my mother again, I should know her. You must expect some change after 12 years, said Mrs. Meyrick gently. See my gray hair? 10 years ago it was bright brown. The days and months pace over us like restless little birds and leave the marks of their feet backward and forward, especially when they are like birds with heavy hearts, when they tread heavily. Oh, I am sure her heart has been heavy for want of me, but to feel her joy if we could meet again, and I could make her know I love her and give her deep comfort after all her mourning, if that could be, I should mind nothing. I should be glad that I have lived through my trouble. I did despair. The world seemed miserable and wicked, and none helped me so that I could bear their looks and words. I felt that my mother was dead, and death was the only way to her. But then, in the last moment, yesterday, when I longed for the water to close over me, and I thought that death was the best image of mercy, then goodness came to me living, and I felt trust in the living. And it is strange, but I began to hope that she was living too. And now I with you, here, this morning, peace and hope have come into me like a flood. I want nothing. I can wait, because I hope and believe and am grateful, oh, so grateful. You have not thought evil of me. You have not despised me. Myra spoke with low-toned fervor and sat as still as a picture all the while. Many others would have felt as we do, my dear, said Mrs. Meyrick, feeling a mist come over her eyes as she looked at her work. But I did not meet them. They did not come to me. How was it that you were taken from your mother? Ah, I am a long while coming to that. It is dreadful to speak of, yet I must tell you. I must tell you everything. My father, it was he that took me away. I thought we were only going on a little journey, and I was pleased. There was a box with all my things in. But we went on board a ship and got farther and farther away from the land. Then I was ill, and I thought it would never end. It was the first misery, and it seemed endless. But at last we landed. I knew nothing then and believed what my father said. He comforted me and told me I should go back to my mother. But it was America we had reached, and it was long years before we came back to Europe. At first I often asked my father when we were going back, and I tried to learn writing fast because I wanted to write to my mother. But one day when he found me trying to write a letter, he took me on his knee and told me that my mother and brother were dead, and that was why we did not go back. I remember my brother a little. He carried me once, but he was not always at home. I believed my father when he said that they were dead. I saw them under the earth when he said they were there, with their eyes forever closed. I never thought of its not being true, and I used to cry every night in my bed for a long while. Then, when she came so often to me in my sleep, I thought she must be living about me, though I could not always see her, and that comforted me. I was never afraid in the dark because of that, and very often in the day I used to shut my eyes and bury my face and try to see her and hear her singing. I came to do that at last without shutting my eyes. Myra paused with a sweet content in her face as if she were having her happy vision while she looked out toward the river. Still, your father was not unkind to you, I hope, said Mrs. Meyrick after a minute, anxious to recall her. No, he petted me and took pains to teach me. He was an actor, and I found out after that the Coburg I used to hear of his going to at home was a theater. But he had more to do with the theater than acting. He had not always been an actor. He had been a teacher and knew many languages. His acting was not very good, I think, but he managed the stage and wrote and translated plays. An Italian lady, a singer, lived with us a long time. They both taught me, and I had a master besides who made me learn by heart and recite. I worked quite hard, though I was so little, and I was not 9 when I first went on the stage. I could easily learn things, and I was not afraid. But then and ever since I hated our way of life. My father had money, and we had finery about us in a disorderly way. Always there were men and women coming and going. There was loud laughing and disputing, strutting, snapping of fingers, jeering, faces I did not like to look at, though many petted and caressed me. But then I remembered my mother. Even at first, when I understood nothing, I shrank away from all those things outside me into companionship with thoughts that were not like them. And I gathered thoughts very fast because I read many things, plays and poetry, Shakespeare and Schiller, and learned evil and good. My father began to believe that I might be a great singer. My voice was considered wonderful for a child, and he had the best teaching for me. But it was painful that he boasted of me and set me to sing for show at any minute as if I had been a musical box. Once when I was 9 years old, I played the part of a little girl who had been forsaken and did not know it, and sat singing to herself while she played with flowers. I did it without any trouble, but the clapping and all the sounds of the theater were hateful to me, and I never liked the praise I had because it all seemed very hard and unloving. I missed the love and trust I had been born into. I made a life in my own thoughts quite different from everything about me. I chose what seemed to me beautiful out of the place and everything, and made my world out of it. And it was like a sharp knife always grazing me that we had two sorts of life, which jarred so with each other. Women looking good and gentle on the stage and saying good things as if they felt them, and directly after I saw them with coarse, ugly manners. My father sometimes noticed my shrinking ways, and Signora said one day when I had been rehearsing, "She will never be an artist. She has no notion of being anybody but herself. That does very well now, but by and by you will see she will have no more face and action than a singing bird." My father was angry, and they quarreled. I sat alone and cried, because what she had said was like a long, unhappy future unrolled before me. I did not want to be an artist, but this was what my father expected of me. After a while, Signora left us, and a governess used to come and give me lessons in different things, because my father began to be afraid of my singing too much. But I still acted from time to time. Rebellious feelings grew stronger in me, and I wished to get away from this life, but I could not tell where to go, and I dreaded the world. Besides, I felt it would be wrong to leave my father. I dreaded doing wrong, for I thought I might get wicked and hateful to myself, in the same way that many others seemed hateful to me. For so long, I had never felt my outside world happy, and if I got wicked, I should lose my world of happy thoughts where my mother lived with me. That was my childish notion all through those years. Oh, how long they were! Myra fell to musing again. "Had you no teaching about what was your duty?" said Mrs. Meyrick. She did not like to say religion, finding herself on inspection rather dim as to what the Hebrew religion might have turned into at this date. "No, only that I ought to do what my father wished. He did not follow our religion at New York, and I think he wanted me not to know much about it. But because my mother used to take me to the synagogue, and I remembered sitting on her knee and looking through the railing and hearing the chanting and singing, I longed to go. One day when I was quite small, I slipped out and tried to find the synagogue, but I lost myself a long while till a peddler questioned me and took me home. My father, missing me, had been in much fear and was very angry. I too had been so frightened at losing myself that it was long before I thought of venturing out again. But after Signora left us, we went to rooms where our landlady was a Jewess and observed her religion. I asked her to take me with her to the synagogue, and I read in her prayer books and Bible, and when I had money enough, I asked her to buy me books of my own, for these books seemed a closer companionship with my mother. I knew that she must have looked at the very words and said them. In that way, I have come to know a little of our religion and the history of our people, besides piecing together what I read in plays and other books about Jews and Jewesses, because I was sure my mother obeyed her religion. I had left off asking my father about her. It is very dreadful to say it, but I began to disbelieve him. I had found that he did not always tell the truth, and made promises without meaning to keep them. and that raised my suspicion that my mother and brother were still alive, though he had told me they were dead. For in going over the past again, as I got older and knew more, I felt sure that my mother had been deceived, and had expected to see us back again after a very little while. And my father, taking me on his knee and telling me that my mother and brother were both dead, seemed to me now but a bit of acting to set my mind at rest. The cruelty of that falsehood sank into me, and I hated all untruth because of it. I wrote to my mother secretly. I knew the street, Coleman Street, where we lived, and that it was not Blackfriars Bridge and the Coburg, and that our name was Cohen then, though my father called us Lapidoth because he said it was a name of his forefathers in Poland. I sent my letter secretly, but no answer came, and I thought there was no hope for me. Our life in America did not last much longer. My father suddenly told me we were to pack up and go to Hamburg, and I was rather glad. I hoped we might get among a different sort of people, and I knew German quite well, some German plays almost all by heart. My father spoke it better than he spoke English. I was 13 then, and I seemed to myself quite old. I knew so much, and yet so little. I think other children cannot feel as I did. I had often wished that I had been drowned when I was going away from my mother. But I set myself to obey and suffer. What else could I do? One day when we were on our voyage, a new thought came into my mind. I was not very ill that time, and I kept on deck a good deal. My father acted and sang and joked to amuse people on board, and I used often to hear remarks about him. One day when I was looking at the sea and nobody took notice of me, I overheard a gentleman say, "Oh, he is one of those clever Jews, a rascal, I shouldn't wonder. There's no race like them for cunning in the men and beauty in the women. I wonder what market he means that daughter for." When I heard this, it darted into my mind that the unhappiness in my life came from my being a Jewess, and that always to the end the world should think slightly of me, and that I must bear it, for I should be judged by that name. And it comforted me to believe that my suffering was part of the affliction of my people, my part of the long song of mourning that has been going on through ages and ages. For if many of our race were wicked and made merry in their wickedness, what was that but part of the affliction borne by the just among them, who were despised for the sins of their brethren? But you have not rejected me. Myra had changed her tone in this last sentence, having suddenly reflected that at this moment she had reason not for complaint, but for gratitude. "And we will try to save you from being judged unjustly by others, my poor child," said Mrs. Meyrick, who had now given up all attempt at going on with her work, and sat listening with folded hands and a face hardly less eager than Mab's would have been.
"Go on, go on, tell me all."
After that we lived in different towns, Hamburg and Vienna the longest. I began to study singing again, and my father always got money about the theaters. I think he brought a good deal of money from America. I never knew why we left. For some time he was in great spirits about my singing, and he made me rehearse parts and act continually. He looked forward to my coming out in the opera. But by and by it seemed that my voice would never be strong enough. It did not fulfill its promise. My master at Vienna said, "Don't strain it further. It will never do for the public. It is gold, but a thread of gold dust." My father was bitterly disappointed. We were not so well off at that time. I think I have not quite told you what I felt about my father. I knew he was fond of me and meant to indulge me, and that made me afraid of hurting him, but he always mistook what would please me and give me happiness. It was his nature to take everything lightly, and I soon left off asking him any questions about things that I cared for much, because he always turned them off with a joke. He would even ridicule our own people, and once when he had been imitating their movements and their tones in praying only to make others laugh, I could not restrain myself, for I always had an anger in my heart about my mother, and when we were alone I said, "Father, you ought not to mimic our own people before Christians who mock them. Would it not be bad if I mimicked you, that they might mock you?" But he only shrugged his shoulders and laughed and pinched my chin and said, "You couldn't do it, my dear." It was this way of turning off everything that made a great wall between me and my father, and whatever I felt most I took the most care to hide from him. For there were some things, when they were laughed at, I could not bear it. The world seemed like a hell to me. Is this world and all the life upon it only like a farce or a vaudeville, where you find no great meanings? Why then are there tragedies and grand operas where men do difficult things and choose to suffer? I think it is silly to speak of all things as a joke, and I saw that his wishing me to sing the greatest music and parts in grand operas was only wishing for what would fetch the greatest price. That hemmed in my gratitude for his affectionateness, and the tenderest feeling I had toward him was pity. Yes, I did sometimes pity him. He had aged and changed. Now he was no longer so lively. I thought he seemed worse, less good to others than to me. Every now and then, in the latter years, his gaiety went away suddenly, and he would sit at home silent and gloomy, or he would come in and fling himself down and sob, just as I have done myself when I have been in trouble. If I put my hand on his knee and say, "What is the matter, Father?" he would make no answer, but would draw my arm around his neck and put his arm round me and go on crying. There never came any confidence between us, but oh, I was sorry for him. At those moments, I knew he must feel his life bitter, and I pressed my cheek against his head and prayed. Those moments were what most bound me to him, and I used to think how much my mother once loved him, else she would not have married him.